What's up? It's Delaney, and I'd love to invite you to become an honorary co-host of the Self-Helpless podcast. Do you want to pick episode topics and guests? Done. Want to surprise your loved ones with shout-outs on the show for a birthday, project launch, a much-needed divorce? Whatever you're up to, would love to be a part of the celebration. Get your favorite and least favorite quotes featured on the podcast, submit questions for our special guests, and find lots more new features and surprises at patreon.com/selfhelpless. You'll also get added to our Patreon Insider email list to easily redeem rewards via a quick email reply. Because we know hanging out on Patreon isn't everyone's thing. You can also opt out of emails if you prefer to be a silent supporter of the show. And don't worry, we do not Scrooge McDuck these contributions. 100% of proceeds go directly to operating expenses that make this weekly podcast possible and available to all. Learn more at patreon.com/selfhelpless or simply click the link in this episode's description. Thank you for helping me fill the void of being the last standing host of the Self-Helpless podcast. Thank you so much.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I'm no good at taking good advice, and I'm self-careless, so don't tell me twice that lately I've been so stuck in my head that I forget just about everything my therapist said. Maybe I'm self-helpless. Maybe I'm self-helpless. Maybe I'm self-helpless. Maybe we are all self-helpless.
Hey everyone, welcome to Self Helpless. I'm Delaney Fisher, and today I'm joined by a guest who truly provided so many aha moments in this episode. I'm chatting with Cara Lowenthal, who is the host of the podcast Unfuck Your Brain and author of the book Take Back Your Brain: How a Sexist Society Gets in Your Head and How to Get It Out. Whether you've been socialized as a boy or girl in our society, I don't know about you, but I've become increasingly more aware the last handful of years around how my conditioning as a girl and a woman has impacted my mental health, how I view myself, how I approach different conversations or goals, my relationship with productivity. And this conversation was exactly what I needed in order to deepen my understanding around this kind of conditioning. And I think it's going to validate a lot of women's feelings today and those who have been socialized as women, because the messages that we receive throughout our lives is that our self-worth depends on what we look like, what we do for other people, our accomplishments. So we talk about how men and women have been socialized differently and the impact it has on everything, our sense of worth, how we handle finances, anxiety and imposter syndrome, the list goes on, and really how we can close what Cara refers to as the brain gap, how we can reframe and rewire what society has told us about ourselves in order to become more of who we are. So in this episode, we touch on things like invisible labor, thoughts around things like how women are taught to shave their legs and wear makeup and men aren't, what role capitalism has played in our relationship with productivity, the ways women treat themselves so poorly and even use their idea of feminism against themselves, and how we can start unraveling this conditioning so we can feel less anxious and more confident and empowered. So here's Cara Lowenthal. Could we just start off with maybe sharing a little bit about your background and your work and why you do what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I always say that I came from the well-established Ivy League lawyer to life coach pipeline. It's, you know, what your parents hope will happen when you go to Harvard Law School.
So, of course.
So I had a very traditional career before I started doing this work. I went to Yale undergrad. I went to Harvard Law School. You know, the whole nine yards, graduated with honors, clerked on a federal appeals court. I was a reproductive rights litigator.
Oh, wow.
Jeez. And then I was an academic. So I worked on the intersections of women's rights and religious rights. So that was the career path I was on. The next step was becoming a law professor. And I made a hard left at the last minute and jumped ship. And started my own, became a, got certified as a life coach and started my own business. And now it's 8 years later. And I have about 10 employees. I run a multi-million dollar business.
Incredible.
I have a coaching membership that's got about 3,000 women in it. And all of that is based around the kind of core insight that I think I offer people, I'm offering to your listeners and in my work, which is that a lot of the way that we think about ourselves is based on messages that we absorbed from society that we're not aware of. And so when I came to coaching just trying to like get coached as a person, as a client for, you know, help with my life, like many people do. And it was really clear to me even from the beginning that some of what I was learning in terms of the kind of tools for changing my thinking were extremely powerful, but the like explanation of why my brain was the way it was really lacking, because it didn't have this aspect of what society has taught me to think about myself based on being a woman, based on, you know, for me being in a larger body, for me being based Jewish, for me being white, for somebody else might be totally different identities. But the kind of coaching world as a whole was not really taking into account any of that. And that meant that the tools were not as effective as they could be, because, you know, if you don't really, you can have a good medication, but if you don't really understand the illness, then you can only use it bluntly at best.
Right.
And so my work has really focused on like building out and illuminating how society impacts the way that we think, how we internalize that. I call that socialization, if you hear me use that term in this conversation, and how particularly women and people socialized as women can learn to actually change the way that their brain thinks, literally change the thoughts you have, so that they can kind of overcome a lot of those limitations that we absorb from society.
Incredible. Was there like a certain moment where you knew I have to shift gears? Goodbye, Harvard Law, all these things. I mean, what was going through your head? And was it the fact that you came to the, you know, coaching for your own life and stuff, and that's what did it? But I would love to know. That's a big decision, and I'd love to know how you made it.
I think there were two big inflection points. So I have a book coming out called Take Back Your Brain, and which is available for pre-order now, takebackyourbrainbook.com. And but the book starts with kind of that first inflection point, which was me on the desk, under the desk, sorry, not on the desk, under the desk in a fetal position at my reproductive rights litigation job, because I had essentially spent like 8 years of my life kind of trying to get that specific job.
Wow.
And I'd gotten it. And shockingly, it had turned out that didn't completely resolve my confidence problem or my imposter syndrome or all my negative thoughts. And so I had this sort of breakdown moment there. And that was the inflection point that started me on the path of even just looking into coaching for myself as a person. So that was sort of one point. And in the next few years, you know, I didn't immediately quit to become a coach. I continued. I thought I was staying on my career, and I was just trying to get coaching to like feel better about my life and feel more empowered in my life. And then the second inflection point, there wasn't really one. I mean, I woke up one morning and it felt like I had this little revelation that was like, I'm going to quit. I'm going to become a coach. I'm going to work. At the time, back then, I worked with women lawyers because that was like the people I knew best, sort of. So it felt like it was this revelation. But I will say that maybe 3 or 4 months later, I was having lunch with this friend of mine who I only saw like every 6 months when I was in San Francisco. And I told her like, oh my God, big news, you know, like who would have ever thought? And she was kind of like, you joke about quitting your job to become a life coach all the time. You're always saying you want to quit your job and become a life coach and move to Costa Rica. And I was like, oh yeah, I do always say that. I didn't really want to move to Costa Rica. That was a red herring. But I did think that was kind of fascinating that like, but it had been something I couldn't even admit to myself, right? This is something a lot of women experience, which is like, you've been told who you're supposed to be acceptable, to be lovable, to be worthy. And that, you know, can be defined by society, can be defined by your family, your religion, your community, whatever. But one thing's for sure, if you're a woman, you've been told who you're supposed to be, whether from one source or many. And so you can't even necessarily admit to yourself what you want to do. So although it felt like I woke up one morning with this whole revelation, apparently I had been talking about it for a long time. And I found that when I coach a lot on, you know, women sort of saying like, I don't even know what I want to do. It's like, and at any stage in life, it'll be like women being like, you know, I hate my job, or I don't fulfill my career, but I don't know what I want to do. It's women who are retired and like, I don't know what to do in this new phase of my life. But when I get down to it, there's always some secret thing they want to do. They just don't think it's realistic, or they think because they failed before they can't do it, or what would so-and-so think, or what would their, you know, their mother who's been dead for 30 years think, or like, it, like people talk a lot about this sort of not knowing what they want. But my experience with people socialized as women is that they do know what they want, but they've just told themselves that thing's not possible. So what they're really saying is, if I can't have what I actually want, then I don't know what I want, which, sure. I mean,
yeah,
that's how that goes.
Right. Oh, you brought up so many good points. I would love to hear, you know, how have women been socialized differently, and what kind of impact does that have on how we view ourselves, how we approach our needs, things like that, you know, just throughout our whole lives.
Small
just
questions.
A little concepting question. I'm sure you can answer it in a sentence or two. But
I mean, I will also say, of course, men receive socialization based on their gender. That is also not helpful, is one disclaimer. But I'm just here mostly talking about people socialized as women. I mean, men are socialized to believe that, you know, like any feeling other than anger is a weakness, and that's not great for them. So this is not to say that it's only a problem for women. Right. Also, I certainly believe there's more than two genders. Men and women are not the only options. But when we're talking about how the dominant society talks to us, that's what the dominant society assumes, right? So that's why I say women or people socialized as women, anybody who sort of was the target of that socialization at some point. Mm-hmm. So I think if you break it down like really fundamentally, the difference is that there are certainly things that men are taught that they, you know, should do, like they should have a career and be a provider and like, absolutely. But on a fundamental level, I think that men, I'm actually not sure if they're actively taught this or it's just they're not taught the opposite, but they're raised believing that like they're allowed to have preferences and desires and opinions, and like what they want matters somewhat in their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's I just, you know, even from a young age, like you just, you see the sort of ways that they are more likely to feel, you know, entitled in even a healthy way to just have their own preferences, beliefs, opinions be part of the conversation or be what they base their decisions on. And women are socialized to believe that their own preferences, beliefs, and opinions are irrelevant at best, irrational and wrong at worst, that their value, that they don't really have inherent value just for existing. Their value comes from what they do for other people and what other people think of them. So I think a lot of women experience it as like, it's like your value is the stock market. It like depends on what everybody else is thinking about you at any given time. And that includes like people you meet, people you don't even know, people you knew 20 years ago, people who are dead. Like it's all in your head. You're like running all of your choices and your existence through like, what does everybody else think about this? And that is how you're trying to navigate the world, which is very destabilizing and overwhelming.
Oh gosh, I love that analogy of the stock market. That is just perfect way to put it. I would love to hear your perspective. Like, could you break down invisible labor? What it is? How do we know when we're experiencing it? I didn't hear about this concept until maybe my late 20s. And wow, like it woke me up to a lot. And I really wish I would have learned about it earlier. But yes, anything that you want to share about that?
So I think people use those terms in a lot of different ways. So I'm curious, do you mean sort of the like logistical labor that a lot of women do, especially in partnerships and marriages? Do you
Great
mean
question.
Emotional labor?
I think what I noticed in my own relationship is that when I took a break and my husband took a break, they looked very different. Like my breaks were doing the dishes and doing the laundry, and those were my breaks from work. And his break was a real break, like watching football or playing video games or something. And I wasn't even aware that I was doing that. It was just kind of the default, and started learning more about that concept. Like, oh my gosh, why am I doing this? Why am I not taking a real break? And it wasn't being forced to. So I don't know if that would is if that's invisible labor or not,
Absolutely.
But would love your perspective on that.
So I think that comes from a couple of different sources, right? So one is, and this goes for everything I'm saying, a lot of what I'm describing these days doesn't get said to you explicitly as socialization.
Yeah.
You just see it modeled. Now, it wasn't that long ago that somebody would just have said explicitly to you, well, he's your husband. That's why he gets to rest. And it's your job as the woman to take care of the house. Like, that would have been a very explicit message, certainly 100 years ago, maybe 50 years ago. Now it's not as explicit, but we still see it around us. Like, what happened in your family? Who did all of the laundry and the washing dishes in your family, and who was sitting on the couch and watching football, right? You sort of pick it up. What do you see in the movies? What do you see in the media? Like, what's happening at your friends' houses? So you absorb all of that. It becomes your unconscious belief that, oh, I'm the gender that's supposed to do these things. Right. And then also, because women are socialized to believe that their value comes from basically service to other people, professional service, domestic service, sexual service, whatever. Mm-hmm. And again, historically, that's what women were forced to be. So it, you know, it makes sense in context that we grow up thinking this. A lot of women feel very unable to relax.
Yeah.
So they actually don't feel like they can sit down and not, if there's dishes or if there's laundry, right? They don't feel able to relax. And sometimes I think we get it a little backwards where we're like mad that our partner who's been socialized differently, it's like, don't you see there's dishes? And I kind of want to be like, what if you're both can relax even if there's dishes in the sink, right?
Right,
like,
exactly.
There are ways that for sure men are socialized to be overly entitled and we need to like draw that backwards. But also women are so under entitled that the answer isn't always that, like, I don't think the dream scenario is that neither person in your house is able to ever relax if there's anything to be done in the household. It's like, we've been fucked up. Sorry, can I curse on this podcast?
Oh, yes, yes, please.
Okay. It's like, we've been socialized into a very fucked up thought pattern about this.
Yeah.
And then it's like, we think equality would be like, my male partner should also have an equally fucked up thought pattern where he also can't relax if there's dishes in the sink.
Right.
And I'm like, no, I think that maybe what we should work on is you also being able to relax even if there's dishes in the sink. Like, that's what we need to unwind. So but because we're so embedded in it and we don't even see that, it's like we think the only solution is everyone should feel as sort of self-critical as I do about the household, when I think really the goal is, like, you know, divorcing ourselves, really rewiring our brains, changing our thought patterns so that we don't have this implicit belief that, like, the state of the house is our responsibility, means something about us, that our kind of work can't be done. We're not allowed to relax until everything is perfect.
Yeah. So interesting.
Ends, especially in modern life. Like, you're never going to get to that point. There's always stuff you could be doing. And there's an entire, you know, algorithmic driven platforms giving you ideas of things you didn't even know you could be doing.
Right.
Like, my grandmother was not, if she actually got all the housework done, she didn't sit down and think, you know what I should do is I need to reorganize the snack drawer so it looks like the Pinterest thing I saw. You know, like, it's like a
good
never
point.
Ending.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
The performance of domestic perfection has also been, like, commodified on social media platforms. So it's never going to be enough. So we have to learn how to change the way we think about it.
Oh my gosh, what a great point. Yeah, I with my husband and I feel like we have been a good balance for each other, where he has really helped me relax just by being himself and watching how he behaves. And I've helped him kind of tighten some things up in areas.
Yeah.
And it makes, and it's like, so much of it is our socialization, I'm sure.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
I'm curious, like, you obviously, you mentioned helping people get over their way of or like reframe their thinking, right? To go for the things that they want. How do you also, like, rectify the fact that just statistically it is harder for women to reach success and achieve, and the wage gap and all of that? So how do we kind of, like, bridge that once we're ready to take action? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I come from, in my work, comes from an intersectional feminist background. So that means we are recognizing and putting up front the fact and centering the fact that woman is not a monolithic category, and that there are a lot of different experiences and people have a lot of different both sort of you know, opportunities and barriers, or privileges and oppressions, or like whatever language you want to use.
Yeah.
And I think that self-development gets a bad rap mostly because it's associated with women, and that, you know, if these
men were asked,
oh yeah, are you kidding? Questions like, who do I want to be, and what's possible, and what is the good life, and what's the nature of reality? Like, these are questions that when men ask them, it's philosophy, and you get a chair at Harvard. And when women ask them, I mean, even in the bookstore,
Blowing my mind. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even in the bookstore, like I saw this going around on, I mean, I have been saying this for years, but I just saw a really pithy Instagram post about it or something that was like, my Roman Empire is the fact that the same topics are in the bookstore are marketed to men as leadership books and women as self-help.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
So
yes.
I don't even know how I got on this. This is one of my soapboxes. All right. So.
No, this is so good. Please. I welcome all of those.
I got
please.
It back. I know where I was going. So, okay. So one of the, like, to me, coaching is this incredibly profound practice that is, it's sort of the opposite of like privilege introspection. It is how we can develop mental and emotional kind of resilience in the face of life circumstances that aren't fair. And people will sometimes say like, oh, I'm just so tired of being resilient. And then I'm like, well, that's not actually resilience. Like surviving something hard, that's not actually resilience, that's survival. And that's, you know, that's not a dig at somebody who's in that place.
Right.
But I think real resilience is being able to both acknowledge, yes, there are some things I can't control in the world, but I'm going to try to control everything I can control. Like, right. I think that we overestimate how much we can control things like our loved ones and other people in our lives that we're desperately trying to control all the time, or our bodies. Certain things society like socializes us to think we can control that we actually can't really control.
Right.
But we have way more control than we think we do over our own ability to grow and evolve, and our emotional resilience, and our ability to do hard things, and what we can accomplish and imagine for ourselves, because we're socialized not to have those big dreams, right? We're socialized to like play small. I mean, so it's a long way of saying, to me, the purpose of this work is not to pretend that there's no wage gap, but it is to be able to build up your own kind of belief in your own, psychologists would almost call it like self-efficacy, like your ability to make an impact on your life and direct your own life and create what you want in your life, even when there is an unfair barrier in your way. So an example I often use for my own life is I live in New York City and I live in a fat body. And when I was dating, I'm like in a world where all the dating profiles say like no fatties, height and weight proportional only, active only, like,
wow.
So there's like rampant discrimination in the dating market, quote unquote, right? The message from all of society and every movie you've ever seen is that the fat girl is like the sidekick, or maybe she gets to be paired up with an equally fat man. But certainly you can't be dating, you know, between body sizes. That would be crazy. And there's nothing wrong with dating fat men or women. Obviously, that's the whole point. But it's like portrayed as either non-existent, or you're like the sort of secondary caste that has to like, you have to stay with your own secondary, you know, not as good kind.
Yeah.
So the point isn't for me to like try to gaslight myself to believe that there's no right fat phobia in the dating market or anywhere else, like in marketing. I mean, I have to put my face and body on the internet as a coach. Like, it's not, the point isn't to pretend that fat phobia doesn't exist. The point is to use coaching to decide for myself, like, number one, is this important to me? Like, yes, I want to find a partner. This is really important to me. I'm going to do this. And then B, how do I have to think about it every goddamn day to like stay motivated, to keep building my belief that I can find what I want? And all of that is literally a step-by-step process. Like, I didn't go from thinking, you know, I have to lose weight before I can find a partner, which is what I thought until I was, you know, 35. I didn't like learn about coaching and then the next day believe I can do whatever I want in this body. Like, I built very small step thoughts, including starting with thoughts like some fat women find love. It's like, well, I can't argue with that. Okay. That's slightly better than the thought I had. And then, you know, the next thought was like, I don't need a lot of people. I just need one. And I always say, even if you're non-monogamous, you still only need a few. It's like, doesn't have to be everybody. There's a lot of people in the world. Right. So I like had to build that belief bit by bit. So the power of thought work and this sort of cognitive change work I do to me is we're not like manifesting and believing in vibrations and like you create everything that happens to you. And we're not gaslighting ourselves that structural forces don't exist. We're really equipping ourselves to choose our beliefs for ourselves. Like, what is the way you can be the most impacted by and the most captured by an oppressive society is by believing everything they tell you about what's possible for you and who you are. So there's this weird thing. I mean, I come from the social justice world, and there is this weird thing that happens on the social justice side sometimes that gets sort of too disempowering to me. That's kind of like, society is, you know, there's oppressive systems in society, and they mean that kind of there's no hope and you can't do anything about your life. And that's somehow supposed to be like empowering, but actually I think that's completely disempowering. And that's actually what those systems would tell us is true. Like, who tells you as a woman that you can't have that kind of job? The patriarchy. So if you totally internalize that that's the case and believe it 100%, you're actually just believing what the patriarchy told you to believe. Right. So that is a balance, but I think it's like the most potent form of this work absolutely takes account of structural injustices, but it doesn't make them mean that what you are trying to do is impossible for you.
Right. And I love the way that you broke down the incremental thought changes. It's not 0 to 100, or it's not maybe going to shift overnight, but those things that you can build up to. I would love to talk about how, you know, we've been socialized to think about our bodies, what to do to them, all of that, right? You know, we've been told, you know, wear makeup and shave your legs and all these things. My husband is not doing any of those things. And I find myself questioning, do I actually feel better when I do this stuff? Or have I just been told that, it should be done to be more attractive or more lovable, and that's why I feel better? What about if you feel like the lines are so blurred where you don't actually know if you like something because you truly do, or
but
because
you're conditioning? But I don't think there's any such thing. I mean, I almost think like it's not a helpful question because you'll never know.
Right.
Of course you like those things because you've been socialized to, but that's true of everything. Like
right.
The foods that we eat have to do with what our culture is, and what does our culture tell us tastes good or doesn't taste good, or is yummy or gross or whatever else, right?
Right.
That's why you can go to a different culture and they have an entirely different set of foods that you would never eat, and vice versa.
Yeah.
So this is a very common question that people get into, but when I'm coaching around this, I'm always trying to like disrupt that spin, because we're never going to know, right? We can't get to a state of pre-socialization.
Right.
I don't know like who I would be if I'd never been toilet trained, which is a form of socialization. Right. Like, it
True.
Doesn't matter.
Good point. Yeah.
So
yeah.
The point isn't to use self-coaching or thought work to like get to some sort of romantic primal state where you are your true essential nature. You know, I mean, some psychologists and philosophers would say the self doesn't even really exist. It's just thoughts over time. So there may not even be an essential thing. Maybe what you thought and felt at 20 is different than 35, and neither one is like the real you. So it's not that useful. The question to me is really, I'm like very practical. How's it impacting your life now? So when somebody says to me like, well, I just feel better wearing makeup and I don't think that's a problem, I'm like, I don't think it's a problem either. Right. Here's what I do think is a problem. Can you not leave the house without makeup because you feel anxious and bad about yourself? Are you unable to feel attractive without makeup? Like, that's when it's a problem to me, right? Are you letting it in, not letting it like it's your fault, but just, you know, has the socialization impacted you to the extent that you are, that it doesn't feel like a choice to you? Right. And that you are not able to kind of feel empowered in its absence. If that's the case, then again, like, everybody gets to decide. I'm not here to tell anybody what they should think. But for me, I don't want my self-esteem to be based on whether I have lipstick on. I mean, what if Armageddon happens and there's no more lipstick?
Right.
I don't want to feel like I want to feel sexy even in Armageddon or whatever. That'll probably be the least of my problems. But what maybe we have to repopulate the earth. You know, I got to be able to get in the mood.
Right.
So, but it's like, whatever it is, it could be makeup, it could be your clothes, it could be being in a relationship. Like, people, I don't think that we can ever undo the amount of socialization that women get about romantic relationships all the way. I mean, I did multiple episodes on my podcast about like the real, the conflict I feel about like being engaged and getting married, not just sort of as a feminist, but also feminists are not against marriage or engagement, but just as somebody who's like done all this work to kind of break down all that socialization that makes women feel like they are more valuable in a relationship, that they need to be in a relationship to be validated, that that's the normal thing, that if they're not, there's something wrong with them. So I've done a lot of that work, probably more than 99% of the people alive, and still getting engaged and deciding to get married, while I feel conflicted about it, there's a sense of social validation. And so the point of this work isn't to like turn it into another thing to be perfect at, or you beat yourself up.
Right.
Like, I got to deprogram myself perfectly.
Defeats the purpose. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, gosh. It's, I see the cycle.
Like,
yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just to like hold that mm-hmm. complexity and be able to, it's to have a relationship with yourself where you can both be trying to change some of those thought patterns just for your own health and happiness, but not trying to be perfect at it, not trying to like, you know, always right. get it right or like come to the right outcome. It's like the right out. It's not the right outcome to coach yourself to not wear makeup. Nobody's right. deciding what the right outcome is.
Right.
It's just you. How do you feel? But women always want the right answer because we've been socialized to believe that we can't trust ourselves and we can't trust our discernment and we can't trust our judgment and we're emotional and irrational and hormonal and blah, blah, blah. So we're always, yeah. you know, it's all the women who come through my coaching membership are like, of course they just want like, what are the rules? And this is my new thing. So like, how do I do this perfectly?
How can I ace the test and be the
yeah,
best student?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. How can I, yeah. right? And I'm always saying like, you don't have my permission to use my work to like judge and evaluate yourself and beat yourself up. But that is our instinct, because that's what women have been trained to do.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I like this idea of asking yourself maybe why. Yeah. Just kind of why, like, do you feel like you're still worthy, you know, without makeup on, or yeah, like Armageddon happens, you know, L'Oreal doesn't exist. Are you still going to feel like, you know, you can feel beautiful? Or, and I don't know the answer to that question for myself, if I'm being really honest.
And what does beautiful mean? Right. That's right. also very constructed. There's a right. big, like, I'm frequently saying to women, like, people have been fucking for a long time even before we had makeup.
Right. Like,
so like, what does that mean? Right. When we say I don't feel beautiful, if what we mean is
yeah.
I don't feel the validation that I get when I'm conforming to social expectations to groom myself a particular way. And I'm like, yeah, well, I don't know if it is a good idea to spend your life trying to feel beautiful in that way. Right. That's
right.
It's like, what do these words even mean to you? Women are given all of these things they're supposed to be. I'm supposed to be confident. I'm supposed to be caring. I'm supposed to be beautiful. I'm supposed to be supportive. I'm supposed to be blah, blah, blah. And then when I'm coaching, it's like, what does that word mean? And we're like, I don't know. I just know I'm never doing it right.
Oh,
I just know
gosh.
I'm never doing it right. I don't actually know what it is.
There's so many layers to it. I mean, it's
like rabbits
just
all
endless.
The way, turtle all the way down. I'm always saying rabbits all the way down. And someone's always like, it's turtles. I'm like, okay, but it's, I like rabbits because it's like rabbit holes. And also it's a funnier image.
Right. It's a never ending onion that tastes like shit.
But the goal isn't to get to the middle of the onion, right? This
right,
is the thing.
Right.
It's like the perfectionism, the perfectionism is sort of like, as if the goal of something of this is to like do it right or do it all the way. And it's none of that. The point is just like, you have however many years you have on this earth. And the statistics are really clear on end of life. People regret the same fucking 4 to 5 things mm-hmm. around the world when they're dying. Mm-hmm. They regret not spending enough time with loved ones. They regret working too much for something they didn't care about.
Yeah.
Right. That gets like translated as just like working, but no, it's like,
yeah,
if you worked on right creating your art, you probably don't regret it. If you killed yourself working at like a law firm that you didn't care about, you might.
Yeah.
So it's like working too much on something they don't care about, you know, not spending enough time with loved ones, caring too much about what other people thought, living their lives for someone else. Mm-hmm. There's maybe another one or two, but like, it's very consistent. So it's like, we have the data. We know that if we live our lives based on trying to conform to social expectations and make everybody else happy, at the end, statistically, we are unlikely to feel like that was a good use of our time. Mm-hmm. So what I really want is not for us to like get perfect at coaching or get back to our pre-socialized self or know for sure whether or not lipstick is our true love or whatever.
Right, right.
It's like, just how can you show up a little bit more like yourself, how can you show up as yourself, really yourself, a little bit more each day or each week or each month, so that at the end of your life, you feel proud of and good about the life. You feel like you've accomplished what you wanted to in this life. Mm-hmm. And you're not looking back and thinking, God, now at the end of it, I see like it didn't fucking matter what everybody else thought. And it didn't matter if my hair was blow dried or not. And it didn't, you know, and like killing myself to make sure that my children all had perfectly coordinated Valentine's Day lunchboxes that looked good on Instagram is like not what I was meant to do with my, that Mary Oliver calls my one wild and precious, your one wild and precious life. Like that's what the work is really about.
Right. Oh, so good. I mean, can we talk a little bit about how we've been, the romantic socialization mm-hmm. that we've had? Totally. What are some big patterns that you see that you think might be helpful for all of us to be aware of that we might not even be realizing is going on?
This is, whew, this was my white whale for a long time. So I am like, I did a lot of work on this area. So in the book, I talk about what I call the four traps of romantic socialization. Mm. And so those are kind of the big four buckets of how I think what we're taught about romance and, you know, sort of dating and sexual relationships impacts our brains as women. Yeah. And so the first one is just insecurity. I mean, women are just still taught, mostly implicitly, but not entirely. Sometimes it is explicit at like a pretty intense level that, you know, your life is not complete unless you have a partner, which mm-hmm. is just mm-hmm. not a message that men get as much. Right. So women are still sort of taught, and people socialize women are still taught that the most important thing about them is to be in a relationship. If they're not in a relationship, then anything else they've accomplished is like, that's great, but it's still kind of sad that they don't have a partner. They're not and that they're not like, and then if they are, that they didn't have children, like whatever it is, you know, the sort of next step on the domestic assembly line.
Yep.
So, and that, you know, there's something wrong with them if they're not in a relationship, that it's normal to be in a kind of committed heterosexual monogamous relationship. And so then if you're not, God forbid you want something different, but even worse that you want that and you're not getting it yet. And so it just becomes like, I think that I see them, and I say this as myself was my first client on this. I think I was definitely the most deranged about this area. Like, I think it is the area that I just see, like, I coach on so many things, but this I sometimes think is the area that just causes like the most intense, frantic anxiety and self like doubt in women, people socialize as women, because it is, you know, something that to some extent does involve other people having to cooperate. And so it's often, especially women who can like make everything else happen in their lives, and then this is not responding to that same like
right
energy. So the first one is insecurity, which you could just boil down as like thinking worse of yourself because you're not in a romantic relationship or you haven't been married or whatever. And what's really weird about this one is also that it's actually more of a thought than a circumstance, because I will frequently coach people about this where I ask them their romantic history and they tell me about like 7 relationships they've been in. But then they always have a reason that like that one didn't count, or it wasn't normal, or it wasn't like
interesting. Yeah.
In their mind, they are someone that nobody ever loves back. And then you'll be like, what about that 4-year relationship? They'll be like, well, that didn't count because, you know, it was on and off, or like they didn't want to commit, or like we never met my parents or whatever.
Huh.
So our brains are just so fixated that we will reinterpret evidence to match.
And is that because like it wasn't perfect, therefore it doesn't count in some way? Like,
no, it's because their fundamental, it's more because their fundamental belief is there's something wrong with them if they don't have this kind of relationship.
Okay.
And so then they distort all evidence to fit that. And they choose partners that validate. We choose what feels familiar and comfortable.
Right.
So if you think nobody would want to like marry me, you're going to keep dating people who don't want to marry you, because that lines up and it doesn't hurt your brain. It all is like, your brain just is like, I want the world to make sense. So whatever I believe, we just got to find experiences that validate that. I'm not interested in being contradicted.
Yeah.
So that's a whole other thing.
Okay.
So trap two is scarcity and settling. Like, you know, there aren't that many good men left. There aren't that many good men. Like, women get these messages that there aren't that many good men, or there aren't that many of the right kind of men, or there aren't enough men to go around. And like, so we have to
snatch him up while you see him.
Just, yeah, grab the first one you see and hunker down.
Right.
So, you know, and all of the, one of the ironies of all this stuff is that like the statistics show that marriage benefits men more than women, but our social narrative is that women are the ones who want marriage and have to like trap men into it. So
wow.
All of these stories contribute to this sort of like, there's not enough to go around, you know, you need to settle.
Mm.
And then the third is fixation and rumination, which just is like constantly thinking about it, replaying it, right? Not being able to, that kind of split brain experience that I know I had and so many women have, that's like, I know that some dude who ghosted me after two dates who I met on Tinder is not the love of my life, but I cannot right. stop thinking about it and replaying it. And like, what did I do wrong? And I just need closure. And what, like that kind of, that happens because in your brain is like, this is proof that I'm not good enough and I'm never going to be good enough. And so I have to like obsessively think about it to try to solve it some other way.
Yeah.
So we get into that like fixation rumination.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And then the fourth one is magical thinking, which is the belief that when you find the right person, it solves all of your problems and you feel good forever, which paradoxically makes it extremely hard to be in a partnership, because what happens is no one you're dating does that for you.
Right.
So it always seems wrong. So you're always like looking for the red flags. You're always blowing up relationships or not continuing them because in your mind, you're like, but I don't feel the way I thought I'd feel. So this must not be the right one.
Right. This is not so, what it's like in the movies and all the right. things
it traps
that I've
in this
been
vicious
right.
cycle. Right. Yeah. So I write in the book really like, and I feel like this was really important for me. I write in the book that about meeting my partner, meeting my fiance, and the fact that like, yeah, he had a fun falling in love experience and I felt fucking terrible. The whole thing felt terrible. Like,
yeah,
it was like not what I had been looking for. I had to like grieve my life of being single and independent. Now I was like partnering. I had not had children intentionally. Now I was partnering up with somebody who had children. Like it was, he was like not the package I thought was coming. I wasn't mentally like, I had done so much work to become available, but I wasn't really fully like ready for that. And it kicked up all of my childhood. I mean, just like it was a lot going on. And right. if I had thought falling in love is supposed to feel good, it should feel like it is in the movies or like what 22-year-olds describe on the internet or whatever.
Right.
Then I would have broken up with him immediately. Right.
So
and I'm not saying it has to feel that way. Some people do have blissful experiences, but there's something in your life. It might not be relationships for you. It might be, I have a friend who's a coach who it took her a really long time to make seven figures in her business for the first time. And for her, that was her thing that she had this magical thinking about of like, you know, when I make that amount of money, I'm going to finally feel good enough about myself. I'm going to finally feel like, you know, I deserve my business and I've arrived and I'm just as good as all my friends in my mastermind. You know, like that was her
right.
fixation, magical thinking thing. And then she made $1 million and she like cried for 2 weeks straight, which doesn't sound sympathetic, but that's
she just kind of realized
like,
this
whatever
wasn't
it is.
The answer.
It can be a weight
yeah.
loss goal. It can be a, I have to move to this city. I have to buy a house. I have to have a kid, whatever it is. If you are like fixated on anything as when I get that, my life's just going to be perfect. So I'm always telling people, like, just imagine you have that thing and you're still in a really bad mood and you feel lonely and sad. Because mm-hmm. that's the human experience. That's what's going to happen.
Right, right.
But we are sold this like, and for women, especially in the realm of relationships, you just get that partner, you just get married, then you are going to feel happy forever and never mm-hmm. feel sad and never feel alone and whatever else. And that's just not true.
Oh my gosh. I could do five different, I could do five podcast episodes just on the things that I have been told about me because I don't want children. Like that's a whole lot of they like, oh my gosh, the things that people say and they feel like canned responses. I mean, I don't think people realize like kind of how robotic it can sound. It's like, you guys all think you're saying something different, but it's the same thing. It's kind of freaky.
Also, you're not allowed to say to people, why would you have children?
Right. Exactly. So why did you do this? I don't really get it, but
this seems loud and really inconvenient. Why did you make this choice?
Right, exactly. I totally fell into, or I guess I caught myself looking back kind of in the trap of that scarcity mindset when I met my husband, of, you know, being raised in California, growing up in like the LA area, you don't date the nicest people is kind of what's out here. And so he had just moved from the Midwest and was here for like maybe 6 months. And I was like, oh my gosh, I got to snatch him up quick before like some other LA person like sees him, you know? And I remember like, oh my gosh, I totally fell into that. Like, gotta snatch him up kind of a thing.
Listen, I found mine, you know, I was like second date after separation. So
okay. It happens, right? I would love to talk maybe a little bit about, I guess, internalized misogyny and like how that whole concept of how, like, I don't know, sometimes we're actually doing, for lack of a better term, like the dirty work for people, by how we treat, how women treat each other even.
I think it's just a reflection about that? Of how women treat themselves.
Right.
Like people sort of say like how women treat women as though women are supposed to be so loyal to other women. Right. Which, like, number one, nobody says that to men. No one's like, I can't believe men are treating men this way. Like,
so true.
Why are women supposed to be just naturally supportive to other people who share our gender identity? Like, that, number one, is a weird concept.
Yes.
Like, any marginalized group is not monolithic, you know?
Yeah.
But also, number two, I mean, women are horrible to themselves. So the idea that we would, like, always be nice to other people, I just think is... you know, is an unrealistic expectation. I mean, I think that I also, you know, what's the right way to say this? Just because I share a marginalized identity with someone doesn't mean that I share their values, their experience. Like, you know, I'm not going to approve of, so let's take, for example, like there's so much fucking trad wife content on Instagram right now.
What is it? Like, trad wife.
It's like women being like, I don't want to be a girl boss. I just want to stay home and have my husband make all the money. And I'm teaching my daughter that she should be a stay at home mother. It's like the last 50 years didn't happen.
Okay.
And they aren't aware that like women's suicide rate went down like 10-20% after no fault divorce was allowed.
Wow.
Like it's like total amnesia about the past.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have a lot of thoughts and feelings about the trad wife content, but like, just because those people and I share a gender identity doesn't mean that like for me to critique the message they're spreading is like tearing other women down, right? The idea that feminism or women's solidarity means that like, yeah, anybody who shares your gender identity, you have to agree with their support is like pretty nonsense. I think the thing that can be problematic that we have to look out for is, and this isn't specific to women, men do this too, I think we see it more, is just that sometimes when a group of people I think has like been really oppressed or had a really hard time or whatever it is, and the norms start to change, I think some people are like, awesome, the norms are changing, this was really hard for me and it doesn't have to be hard for you, and that's great. And some people can feel kind of threatened, I think, or feel kind of like, you know, I had to go through this hard thing and this feels threatening because it sort of implies that maybe I didn't have to go through all that hardship. Like maybe things could have been different. So I, you know, there's some, you know, this, like this comes up in, I'm thinking about, I came from the lawyering background, you know, like you'd hear about older women partners in law firms where it had been really hard to make partner as a woman. And these were women who had done it in like the 60s, the 70s, maybe even the 80s, where they'd forgone having children, or they'd had one kid and never seen them, or they'd had to put up with sexual harassment because it wasn't illegal until the 70s across the country, or whatever else. And, you know, you'd hear there'd be different people had different responses to kind of the equalizing, which we're still not equal, but like more egalitarian practices in firms. Like some women partners were pushing those and were really supportive of that. And then some kind of had this reaction of like, you know, you just need to suck it up and tough it out. And like, that's what I did. And so I think that's a problem, but that's a pretty small section of what gets described as like women tearing down other women. And most of the time what I see it is sort of women thinking that, I guess the assumption being that, like, just because two people are women, they should support each other.
Right.
And, you know, I guess it really depends on what support means. I mean, I support your right to free speech, and I think that you should be allowed to make a living telling other women to stay home as a legal matter, but I'm not going to not say something about it because that's right. doesn't align with my values. So.
Right. Oh my God. It's such a good point of like, yeah, we don't hear that about men. Like, well, men supporting men, men got to support men out there.
People are never like, men are so catty. They're always tearing each other down.
Right. It's just another thing. Again, the layers are never ending. It's just never another ending. Thing that.
It's just a great shortcut. Always ask yourself, has anyone ever said this about a man?
Right. Exactly. Okay. I fell into a little bit of an experiment, and I would love to hear your perspective. This long story short, you know, throughout the years of running my business, I've hired a lot of different contractors, different gender identities, religions, ethnic backgrounds, everything. And noticed maybe like a year and a half ago or so that, you know, the same email that would get sent mm-hmm. that had a kind of a stereotypical women's name at the mm-hmm. bottom of the email signature versus and the same exact email that would get yep. sent that had a man's name at the bottom of the email signature got very different responses.
Yeah, I think there have studies on this.
Oh my gosh. And it was so blatantly obvious that it really, it freaked me out. And I do a couple of things to note. The woman had a much higher title than the man, mm-hmm. right? Producer, operations manager, I could go yep. on. The other one, assistant. Uh-huh. But the male assistant was getting more faster responses, nice, kinder mm. responses. They were, you know, versus the woman sending the email was getting crickets, no response, late responses, things like that. Mm-hmm. The dude sends the same email. They're getting looped in with all these executives within 30 minutes. I mean, it was mm. absolutely outrageous to me. And I noticed that a lot of the people responding, and it was, I guess that's where I kind of thought of like, oh, it's women within the responses too. And I was like, oh, are we doing these things to each other without realizing it? But I don't know.
I wouldn't frame that as we're doing it to women. I think that's a story right. about how women are socialized to respond to men. I mean, exactly. women are socialized.
Right.
It's not women being like, oh, this is from a woman, I won't respond.
Right.
It's like that. If it's a gender breakdown that women are responding quicker to a man, that's because women have been socialized literally for thousands of years. If a man is upset with you, it could be physically dangerous. Now, right. over email, rationally, is that happening? Probably not. But women are socialized to fear authority, especially male authorities, to people please men, especially. Yeah. And for thousands of years, that was literally necessary. I mean, women didn't have legal or economic rights. So you couldn't have your own money. You couldn't have a bank account. You couldn't have a business. You couldn't sign a contract. You couldn't really live on your own. You had to be married mm-hmm. or you were being taken care of by your father or your brother. I mean, until the Industrial Revolution, it really wasn't that feasible for a single woman to have an independent economic life. It wasn't until women could get a job in a factory that that became even an option on a large mm-hmm. scale. So yeah. we've got thousands of years in which it was very necessary to like please and respond quickly to men or men, especially men in authority figures.
Right.
And we got a piddly 200 years of since the Industrial Revolution or less of that not being the case. So I don't think of that as, I mean, there's two different things. It's like, why do men respond more positively to men? That's like male yeah. socialization, the way men are socialized to not respect women. And like, that's a problem we got to solve. That's my next book maybe. And then, but if it's women responding that way, I don't think it's women disrespecting women. I think it's women being socialized to be more responsive to men, largely yes. out of fear.
Absolutely. No, it totally makes sense. And I mean, I got to be honest, it was discouraging. I mean, it was discouraging to see it. Part of me felt like, wow, I feel like I cracked this weird code that mm-hmm. could potentially help me in some ways. But on the
Just
other
change
hand,
your name to Brian.
Exactly. But like on the other hand, it really was this other side of like, oh my gosh, where would I be in my life, in my career, if I was a man, you know? And I don't know. It was a little bit of a downward spiral from there. There was a lot of mm-hmm. reasons why I kind of ended up stepping away a little bit from my business and like the level and capacity that I was running it. But that was one of many reasons. But it just kind of felt like, I don't know, what is the point if this is going to be harder a little bit? I mean,
but I think that's a really important question you have to ask yourself, right? Like, I am sure that if I was like, what's an extreme example to conform? If I got, I don't know, gastric bypass or went on Ozempic and lost 50 or 100 pounds and then started selling a weight loss product to women, I could make a fucking killing. Like, I make less money than maybe I could because of who I am and how I choose to live my life and show up. Right. But I'm okay with that because making the most money possible is not my goal. My goal is to advance this mission of sharing this work with everyone. So I think on some level, like, maybe this comes from being raised Jewish, I don't know, but I just don't think I have the assumption that it's supposed to be that, like, if it's not as easy for me as it is for the person with the most privilege, that, like, I don't mean that something hasn't gone wrong because my whole work is about trying to equalize things. Yeah. But, like, on a kind of personal level, I don't make that I think I just always assumed, like, that the road would be steeper. Right. I mean, I think if you're raised Jewish, you're raised a minority of any kind, you know, you sort of are raised with a story of, like, well, listen, a lot of the time the majority tries to murder us. So, you know, be careful and keep your eyes open. But like, I didn't have that sort of belief. So to me, I don't spend a lot of time comparing, like, I don't spend a lot of time comparing what would my life be like if I were like a straight, tall, white dude? I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't have this business. I wouldn't be teaching this. Who knows what would be happening?
Right.
Yeah. Maybe I would have, you know, I don't know, be running some kind of venture firm, but that's like not what I want to be doing. Yeah. So I just think you have to answer that question. It's like when your brain gives you an unhelpful question, like, what's even the point then?
Yeah.
I think you have to actually ask yourself, okay, let's take that question seriously. What is the point? Right. Why am I doing this? If you don't have a good answer to that, then maybe you shouldn't be doing it. But
yeah,
often you can connect to something else. So I think there's just something, it's like a weird contradiction to hold, but I both believe that I do what I do because I want to teach women to change the way they think about themselves, not just for their own lives, but because if we want to change society, we obviously need some new brains and ideas, because so far, like, the feminist movement is losing ground. Like, we have less reproductive rights now than when I was born. Right. So we need some fresh thoughts, and those are going to come from our brains. So I both believe that this work does help equalize the playing field, and maybe it's just a matter of, like, not taking an unequal playing field personally, or not being willing to go into a space of, like, it's sort of like there's two different ways to say it's not fair. There's like two different emotions you can have behind that. And one is like, this isn't fair and I want to help fix it. And one is, this isn't fair, so I feel sorry for myself, so I'm not going to do anything.
Totally. No, and I totally agree.
Very different. And I'm not saying you were in one of those. I just as I'm talking about this, it's like almost like you can boil it down to that, which it's not fair are you in? One, like, moves you forward, and one keeps you stuck.
Yes. And I think becoming more aware of all of this has made me rethink, what am I doing and why? And why did I want that thing in the first place? Yeah. Does that really resonate with me? And I made a lot of changes based on, okay, what is worth it to me to face these different obstacles and do it anyway? Because that became very clear. And so it was definitely a moment of like, if I really wanted this specific thing enough, I would keep going, but I don't think I do. And I just, you know,
I wouldn't work made as some hard changes. As I do to like be a partner at Goldman Sachs or something. But for somebody else, they do want to work that hard for that, right? It's right. Like, always, what is your driving thing?
Exactly. I would love to talk about the impact that capitalism has on, you know, it took me a long time to realize even what capitalism is and how it impacts our mental health. Anything that you would like to share about that and how it kind of plays into all of this?
First of all, people don't really know what capitalism is. They're using that term to refer to any kind of commerce, which is not the case.
Right.
So, you know, like having a vegetable stand or even running a small business are not necessarily capitalism the way people are using that term.
Right.
But in any case, in terms of mindset stuff, I think that it's not even necessarily capitalism so much as I think actually the Industrial Revolution that changed the way that people think about kind of work and what work is, and turned it into something where value is measured by productivity,
right?
Like the amount you can produce rather than the quality of what you create or any other way of measuring it, sort of. So I think the way it impacts our thought patterns is that, especially, but this is also very American, like other countries, not that they don't have this problem, but like it's particularly American, I think, in some ways. We are socialized to believe that essentially being productive is a moral virtue. And that's not just capitalism. I mean, that's the thing, though. A lot of what people attribute to capitalism is actually Christianity. Like there's people, I think that people just don't, because most people are sort of, if not actively Christian, just generically nothing in a Christian society, they don't see this the way you see it as like a religious outsider. But, you know, the church was teaching that sloth was a sin and laziness was a sin long before we had capitalism, right? And idle work, right. You know, like idle hands are the devil's work. Like all of these kinds of Puritan concepts were happening even before, and then, yes, certainly contemporaneous with industrialization, the Industrial Revolution. So those thought patterns, I mean, people attribute them to capitalism. It's not just capitalism. It's also Puritanism, especially. And the U.S. was founded by Puritans and by one particular type of Christian, right, fundamentalism. So that's really baked into our social culture. And so I think that comes out as, you know, having a hard time resting, especially for women, because women are, I think, particularly susceptible to the idea that their whole value is in what they produce, because they have been taught since for millennia that their value comes from basically producing and caring for children, or producing, you know, taking care of the household. It's been work. It's like you've been a mule, basically. Like your function is to provide, you know, labor in the household. So I think it impacts us in terms of our ability to relax, to take time off, to like constantly be believing we need to be productive. It's like we want to be productive about our time off, which doesn't even really make a lot of sense. So I think there's a lot of that. And then I think, you know, we could have a whole other podcast about like how women are socialized around money and the way they think about money.
Yeah.
And all of that. But that's we'll have to come back and do that.
Oh yeah. I need to have you back for like 10 extra topics. I'm serious. Like I just keep having more and more questions, and anyway, keep going. Yeah, but yes, please.
I mean, I think that's the sort of impact on like our obsession with productivity and our inability to kind of rest. And I think turning the home into like a site of, like, the home has always been economic labor in the sense that like birthing children, taking care of them, cooking and cleaning are things that if you don't have someone doing for free, you have to pay someone to do, or you have to do yourself. So it's like the home has always been economic, but there is this sort of like, I don't know, with sort of like organizing culture, and like there's this whole kind of next level commodification and perfectionism about the home and the home space that I think makes it even harder for women to ever relax, because if your house doesn't look like a Pinterest graphic, then like you should be doing something about that.
Right. Yeah. No, it's like I kind of learned about, okay, how women are socialized first. That was a lot to take in. And then I kind of started learning more about capitalism. Okay, that's a lot. It's like, it's just more and more things that I'm like, why am I feeling like I have to be overly productive all the time? And it's just all of these just never ending bricks that are stacked up is what it felt like. I feel like this is not really a question. I feel like I got a lot of mixed feelings, and I feel like you're somebody who can maybe give me clarity around it, or I don't know, talk through it. But sometimes I feel grateful that I have a partner. He's a man who makes decent money. I'm grateful that we both contribute financially, all that. He's contributing more at this time in our relationship. We've kind of gotten back and forth, and I feel like, yeah, this feels nice to feel taken care of in this way. On the other hand, part of me is like, well, you should be contributing more financially because it's easier for you to make money in a way. And even if we had the same, I don't know, the same job at the same company and the same experience, the same trajectory, statistics show you would be making more. I don't know. I just have a lot of mixed feelings, I feel like, about it. Where like, I feel grateful, but I also feel it's like justified, but I also feel bad about that. There's guilt. I don't know if you could bring any clarity to this.
I mean, like, I could coach you, but that would be something in a different way.
Gotcha.
So what are your thoughts about, your thoughts are that It's nice to be taken care of, but then why do you feel guilty? What is your thought about feeling guilty?
You know, I might feel guilty about that because maybe I feel like, am I a bad feminist in a way for liking to feel taken care of? And more of like, this might be more of a traditional role, and should I be fighting that, or is it okay to enjoy it? Maybe even that is part of it.
Yeah. But I think that's a great example of like women trying to do everything perfectly and using feminism or anything else as a evaluator for whether they're like doing it right or not.
Right.
Or being good enough or not. Right. I mean, I do make all the money in my relationship. And also, I have not ever taken out our trash. I don't think I've ever gone. I mean, I used to take out the trash all the time when I lived by myself. And then I retired him and I haven't taken. But also, I haven't done a dish. Yeah. He does all the dishes too. So like every relationship, you know, makes it work. And I don't think works in a different way. And I don't think that there's just such like what feminism has just been like gotten such a bad and mistaken rap in the world. Like even people who are feminists, I think, are like using it against themselves because women will use fucking anything against themselves. That's like our number one trick is to learn something new and immediately use it to punch ourselves in the face.
Wow. Yeah.
So when I talk about this in the book, that way I'm defining feminism is just there's really only let's assume, you know, we're assuming for this argument, because it's kind of a social construction argument, again we're back to like there's two genders, which isn't true, but in this realm of kind of how society teaches us, there's only three things you can think. Sort of either everybody of every gender should have equal opportunities and is equally worthy, or you could boil it down to two, I guess, or one gender should have more rights and opportunities than the others. And within that, the two main camps would be either men are better than women in some way or should have more rights and opportunities, or women. And nobody even makes the argument that women should have more rights and opportunities. That's like laughable, right? So fundamentally, I think you're either a feminist or you're a sexist. There isn't a third neutral thing. But people conflate like the philosophy of feminism with, you know, the modern American, like specific countries and time limited versions of feminism. Like what is the current American political feminist movement doing, which isn't even a monolith. There's 30,000 little groups inside of that doing different things.
Right.
So when you're asking yourself a question of like, well, is it feminist to like enjoy? Am I anti-feminist if I enjoy being taken care of?
Right, right.
That's not one of the principles of feminism, is not you can't enjoy being taken care of, right? It's that's not the point. The point isn't like when I think about the trad wives, I'm like, I'm fine if you want to stay home. Right. I want you to understand the history and the context and have a goddamn prenup. Like it's not like that certain choices aren't allowed to be made. It's that everybody should be educated and everybody should be informed, and everybody should be like, if you are a trad wife who bargained hard for a good prenup with a husband who's an investment banker, like by all means, if that's what you want to do, fine. And if you're teaching your daughter that it's fine to do that, but that also she needs a prenup, fine. But to be out there like pretending that there's no downside historically to women depending on men for their financial stability, that's where I get bothered. So
makes sense.
Long story short, I think you are using feminism to beat yourself up. This is not coaching, by the way, for anyone listening. I ask her many more questions.
Yes,
and I
wouldn't
be just telling her what to think. This is just a podcast. But I think that you're using feminism to beat yourself up.
Interesting.
Right? Like, it'd be interesting for you to write down, like, what's your definition of a good feminist? It's like somebody, whose, like, actions always perfectly match a very specific feminist agenda, but we're not even sure what the points on it are, but whatever.
Probably.
They
are. Yeah. I don't even know.
No idea. Your brain has no idea. Yeah.
No idea.
It's just a way of beating yourself up.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. So thrilled about your new book. Could you maybe share some like the biggest takeaways that you want people to have, or just anything, maybe a favorite tool, tip, mindset, hack that might be helpful?
I really wrote the book to be like a one-stop shop, start to finish. So
awesome.
I have a podcast called Unfuck Your Brain, which a lot of people have listened to. But as you know from having a podcast is like a geological site of like layer by layer of like how you've been thinking and figuring things out over years, and everything's not in one place. You know, it's like you have to go like try to reassemble the skeleton of the dinosaur bit by bit through an archaeological dig.
Right.
And with the book, my goal with the book is you can pick up the book having no idea what you caught the tail end of this podcast. You don't know anything about thought work. You don't know anything about feminism. You like You have no idea. You thought it was a cookbook. You could like open the book and by the end of the book, you're going to understand what's actually how your brain even works. Most people have no idea how their brain works. Like we're just running around doing whatever this thing tells us to do. And we don't have any idea what's happening.
Yeah.
So you're going to understand how your brain works. Anyone's brain works. You're going to understand how society has taught you to think, whoever you are. So the book is a mix of, you know, there's me explaining thing like I've been doing on this podcast, but then there's a lot of exercises too, questions you answer that help you uncover, like, you know, I've been talking about my experience, somebody who is from a completely different religious community, racial background, you know, part of the country, part of the world can have a very different experience. So it also is full of exercises that help you uncover what did society teach you? Like, what did you internalize? So you're going to understand how brains work in general, your brain in specific, how you were socialized, what you learned, how that's impacting the way that you think and feel and how you act. And then you're going to learn how to change the way you think and feel on purpose. So I walk you through one of my favorite tools I've ever created. It's called the Thought Ladder. That's one of the book is almost all new material because you can't get a book deal for publishing stuff that you already put in your podcast. But the thought tool is like so crucial that I teach that tool anytime I teach anything. And that is the tool that really helps you go from like, my stomach is disgusting to liking how you look in the mirror. Like, how do you do that step by step? So that's the first half of the book is that deep dive into like how your brain works. It's really what I think is the secret to life. Like understanding how to change the way you think, feel, and act is the amount of shit that humans do to try to change how they feel, right? Like the money we spend, we move cities, we leave relationships, we drink, we eat, we shop, we like convert religions, we fake around death and start a new life. Like people do so much shit to try to change how they feel. And like, all you have to do is learn how to change the way you think. And then the second half of the book is a deep dive into different areas of women's lives. So we've got one on kind of, I call it body image, but it's really like your relationship with your body, how you think about and relate to your body, sex and dating, money mindset, work and kind of time management. We get into this productivity stuff we've been talking about.
Oh, great.
Self-confidence. And then the last chapter is really about how this all kind of relates to the bigger world and how we have to, why changing the way that we think is actually crucial to changing the bigger society so that we have fewer of these kind of barriers. So by the time you finish the book, you're going to be a rock star. Like you're going to know what's going on in your brain, how to change it, how to make the world better, whether that's like in your family or the PDA, the PTA, or you like want to be president anywhere in there. I got
Gosh. I cannot wait to read this book. Seriously. I have one more question for you. Then is there a certain tool or something that especially been helpful for you with your own work around all this? I mean, you obviously coach so many people around it. Is there something that you keep coming back to for yourself that's like one of your go-tos?
Yeah. I mean, there's a core tool in the book that is adapted from the model that I learned when I became a coach that we call the coaching model, essentially, that just teaches you how to actually break down what's happening, what you're thinking, what you're feeling, how you're behaving, and then what that's creating in your life for you. Mm-hmm. And so having that, like that breakdown of, it's really, it's a little hard to verbally describe, but it's all, you just have to go through it. You learn how to actually sort of fill in those five lines on a piece of paper that shows you like, what thought am I having? How does it make me feel? So I can give you an example. Let's say that my thought is, you know, there's something wrong with me. That's why I'm not in a relationship. And then I feel either anxiety or maybe shame when I think that. Everybody's different. So there isn't like one feeling that's right for the thought. It's what you feel. Okay. Let's say I feel shame. And so when we feel ashamed, we basically hide. So I like don't swipe. I don't get on online dating. I don't ask to be fixed up. I don't even notice when people are smiling at me in public because I already think that nobody would love me. So why would I be assuming that someone smiling at me might like me, right? So I show up in the world and I act in certain ways that then make me much less likely to find a partner. So the return that I'm creating for myself in my life is that I continue to not find a partner because I'm literally not doing anything that would help me. And I'm probably subconsciously blocking any attention I'm getting. So that's kind of an example of seeing how thinking this way is creating this outcome for you. So the good news is when this episode comes out, the week this comes out, when you pre-order the book, we have a couple of amazing bonuses you get whenever you pre-order the book. But if you pre-order this week, the bonus we're doing is actually a whole little like mini course walkthrough of exactly how to do that coaching model.
Awesome.
So, and that's free with any pre-order copy. So if you go to takebackyourbrainbook.com and you pre-order the book, but it has to be this week to get that bonus. If you're listening to this later, we have other amazing bonuses, like there's a 30-day guided workbook with lots of prompts in it to help you uncover what you're thinking. There's a book club. If you like live interactive, you want to come talk to me, ask me questions about the book.
Nice.
There's lots of fun stuff, but this week only, that's actually what we're giving away, is like the exact how-to of how to use that tool.
Amazing. Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to share and leave people with that we didn't cover today? And then of course, where people can find you, your work, podcast, yeah, book, all the things.
I think the only thing is like, people, because our brains are, because we're perfectionists and we're risk averse, especially for women, we want to be sure that something is true or going to work before we try it. And if you wait to be sure, your life will, you'll never change your life. So if you listen to this podcast and like, it's completely normal to hear everything I'm saying and be like, wait a minute, I have 17 questions and objections. Like, that's right. Totally normal and fine and good.
Yeah.
If any part of you is like, that sounds like it might be useful, or that sounds interesting, or I think this sort of makes sense, then like, I want you to follow that. Don't, for anything, like maybe nothing I said resonated and you're really, you heard an astrologer give a reading that made more sense to you. Whatever it is, the thing that you, mm-hmm, that resonates with you a little, like we so underestimate how much we have the capacity to change our lives when we change our thinking. Like my entire life is different from changing the way that I think. And it wasn't magic and it wasn't overnight, but everything in my life is different. And so many people just don't even let themselves dream of what their lives could be like. And that's what changing your thoughts will do. So don't wait to be sure. Just follow that little spark of like, I think that this makes sense, or this is resonating with me, or I want to know more.
Beautiful. Oh my gosh. And then where people can find all of your,
honestly,
stuff.
Just go to takebackyourbrainbook.com, because my name is long and hard to spell. And if you try to look for me other ways, it will be harder to find me. So all my, like, perfect, even if you don't want the book, which would be silly, it's the best $29 you can spend. But even if you don't want the book, my social media handles are linked there. Perfect. Then you'll be able to see my name. You can Google me. Just go to takebackyourbrainbook.com.
Oh, Cara, thank you so much. Oh my gosh, I cannot wait to have you back for 10 more episodes, because I feel
after
like
this book comes out, man. It's
yes, yes. Oh my gosh, we have so much more to still cover, but thank you so much. I just absolutely loved this conversation, so appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. Thank you to Cara for being on the podcast today. Go check out her work and her book, Take Back Your Brain, How a Sexist Society Gets in Your Head and How to Get It Out. And feel free to come over and join my email list at delaneyfisher.com. It's called the D-List. I like to share different media opportunities and gigs and a variety of different resources over there, especially for multi-hyphenates who are, you know, trying to figure out maybe what direction they want to go in for their career, things like that. I recently just shared an opportunity to be a guest on a daytime talk show. So I get, you know, all these different things in my network that I hear about, I like to share with all of you. And so, yeah, just a fun place. Everything is free. Again, it's at delaneyfisher.com. And we also have some new self-helpless merch coming soon. So I'm really excited about it. And we'll let you know when that's officially available. I think that's it. So have a great rest of your week, and I will talk to you next time.
Thank you for tuning in to the Self-Helpless Podcast. You can find our Patreon community, merch, and other goodies at selfhelplesspodcast.com. We'd be thrilled if you left an iTunes review, shared this episode with a friend, or post about it on Instagram and tag at Self-Helpless Podcast so we can repost you and say hi. Thanks, everyone.